Welcome back, dear listeners, to a new episode of the Response Emergency Medicine Podcast brought to you by Vienna EMS. It's great to have you with us again. You might notice something a little different this time. Yes, we're speaking English again. And that's because this episode isn't just a typical podcast recording. What you're about to hear was originally captured as part of a video-based e-learning project we created together with our dear friends at 123 Sonography as part of our pre-hospital point of care ultrasound online course. And since that course was aimed at an international audience, we were kindly forced to record the interview in English right from the start. So what's on today's menu? Point of care ultrasound in cardiac arrest, or as we call it, PPOCUS in CPR. It's one of those topics that lives at the crossroads of great potential and serious pitfalls. Can it be a game changer? Absolutely. Does it have the potential to derail your resource efforts if misused? Unfortunately, yes, that too. So to explore this delicate balance, I sat down with my colleague and friend, Dr. Tom Hump, consultant anesthesiologist, senior physician at Vienna EMS, and fellow co-developer of our very own in-house PPOCUS project. Tom brings a wealth of experience from both the pre-hospital and clinical world, and I'm thrilled to share his insights with you today. Together, we dive into when ultrasound during CPR truly adds value, how to avoid the common traps, and why sometimes it's the subtle movement of the aortic valve that tells you everything you need to know. And one more thing, you might notice a calm British voice dropping in now and then. Let's just say we've brought in some backup to help keep things structured along the way. So whether you're just getting started with PPOCUS or already deep into the topic, we hope you enjoy this honest, practical conversation. Thanks for tuning in, and as always, enjoy the episode.
Du hörst den Response Notfallmedizin Podcast.
Bitte auf die Leitung.
Deine Wissensquelle zur spannenden Welt der Notfallmedizin. Präsentiert von der Berufsrettung Wien.
Bitte beruhigen Sie sich und geben Sie mir eine Rückrufnummer, ja?
Durch die heutige Sendung führt dich aus dem Team unserer Oberärzte, Dr. Ben Thal.
Tom, thank you so much for sitting down with me and talk about CPR, especially using ultrasound during CPR today.
Thanks for having me again, Ben.
Now, we're both not native speaker in English, but I think we'll get along fine. We also did a pre-roll where we exercised a little bit, so I think our listeners will understand us quite well. Now, this is all about using PPOCUS during CPR, and we know that ultrasound can be utilized during CPR. We know it can help us in decision-making, maybe identify potentially reversible causes, and even monitor the quality of CPR. So, in a nutshell, why should we do it?
Well, this is a good question, Ben. And I think we have to get back to the beginning of ultrasound.
To the roots.
To the roots, yes. So the potentially reversible causes have been in the guidelines for quite many years.
Mm-hmm.
And there was always the problem that we could not identify many of them. So, for instance, pericardial effusion or pulmonary embolism. With ultrasound being introduced in the pre-hospital setting, it was the first time that we were able, at least theoretically, to identify these causes. So at the beginning, the role of ultrasound during CPR was mainly to try to identify right heart dilatation, which would occur as a consequence of pulmonary embolism, and also to identify pericardial effusion, which we thought we maybe could drain and then improve the outcome of the patient. And in addition, we could also identify tension pneumothorax or hypovolemia. Now that ultrasound has been used during CPR for quite some years, it turns out that it is not that easy as we initially thought. So pericardial effusion can easily be identified with ultrasound, but the question arises, what is the consequence? Because most of the patients who do not suffer from traumatic cardiac arrest and have a pericardial tamponade or ultrasound have a ruptured ventricle or a type A dissection, which you cannot solve in the pre-hospital setting. And the problem with right heart dilatation on ultrasound is that during CPR, when your heart does not pump as much as it usually does, the right heart usually gets dilated. But what we know is that ultrasound can cause an increase in pauses of chest compressions. So if you take out your probe during a life support, everyone gets focused on the image because everyone wants to see the heart, fancy images, and wants to determine these reversible causes. And often people forget to do the things that have been proven to help the patient.
As usually in advanced life support. I mean, we've been teaching them for years not to look on the monitor during the pause, you know, where they're trying to find.
Yes, do not feel the pulse after.
Yeah,
after,
absolutely.
The rhythm check. And this is the same with ultrasound.
Yeah. And now there's even a second monitor coming in with fancy videos and loops and everything. So that's the big hazard, I guess.
Exactly. And there are many studies out there that have shown that if you do not put a focus on reducing the pauses of chest compressions, ultrasound has a real risk that this becomes a problem.
Hi to all EM docs, advanced paramedics, and healthcare professionals out there. My name is Dorothy, an artificial intelligence with a polished British accent and a particular interest in structured communication. Yes, I know, it's a bit unusual. A perfectly enunciated British voice suddenly chiming in between two Austrian ultrasound fanatics. But let's be honest, when two Austrian natives attempt to change the world one podcast at a time, someone has to keep things at least mildly intelligible, and ideally, in actual English. So I'll be dropping in now and then just to summarise, clarify, and keep the chaos charming, shall we? So far, we've heard a thoughtful exchange between Tom and Ben on the use of point-of-care ultrasound during out-of-hospital cardiac arrest. Tom reminded us that while ultrasound can theoretically help identify reversible causes, such as tamponade, pulmonary embolism, or tension pneumothorax, its practical value during active CPR is often limited. More importantly, both agreed that scanning must never come at the expense of high-quality chest compressions. So please, please bear in mind, the ultrasound image is not the priority. High-quality chest compressions with minimal interruptions are. Tom also highlighted the risk of distraction, which makes perfectly sense, because introducing an ultrasound monitor can shift focus away from the fundamentals of advanced life support. The takeaway so far? Use ultrasound with purpose. Know what you're looking for. And above all, don't stop doing what actually saves lives. Now back to the conversation.
Okay, so next question. Why should we use it then?
I think we should use it in an attempt to identify potentially reversible causes, but we have to be aware that in most cases we will not see these reversible causes. Another thing is that we can do some prognostication with ultrasound. So a heart that is completely still is hard to resuscitate. It's not impossible, but the chances to survive this are quite low. And the third reason why we should use ultrasound in CPR is that in the peri-arrest setting, so before the arrest actually occurs, you can really get important information. And also in the time after the resuscitation attempt, so when the patient has ROSC, you can use ultrasound to aid your management.
Absolutely. So what we keep in mind is also not to get frustrated if it doesn't work. It's like the same if you're doing an EFAST, like we heard in the previous chapter. You're doing an EFAST and one view is, for example, blocked or you don't see it. It's just all about not sticking with it and delay the time for the patient.
Yes. Yeah. So during CPR, when you use ultrasound and you use the subxiphoidal view, you usually get a view to the heart.
So the first thing you do is you select your preset and then you throw the probe on. And your go-to window would be the subxiphoid view. Is that correct?
Yes, this is correct. But this is a logical consequence of the entire scenario. Because if you want to go for a parasternal view, there are hands or a Lucas device that does chest compression, so you can't put your probe there. And at the apical window, there usually is a defibrillator probe, so the only one that is left is the subxiphoidal.
So you know what? Let's just jump to a case to make it a little bit more experienceable. Let's just think we are at the scene with a 50-year-old patient with a non-traumatic cardiac arrest. ALS is already fully established. Patient has his medication, he has his endotracheal tube, for example. And it now comes to evaluate for potential reversible causes.
Yeah, for me, the next question that first comes up is, what is the underlying rhythm?
Yeah.
If it is VF, then there is no role for ultrasound because VF is treated by defibrillation. And in patients with refractory VF, we have to think about ECMO, so extracorporeal life support, and probably should take the patient as quickly as possible to an ECMO center and not waste time by using ultrasound.
And I think it's mostly caused by myocardial ischemia as well.
Yeah, exactly. So VF is usually caused by ischemia, and you can't identify myocardial ischemia with ultrasound in patients who are in cardiac arrest because you do not see the wall motion abnormalities.
Okay, so that makes sense. So it quickly comes to the non-shockable rhythms.
Yes. So let's assume the patient has a non-shockable rhythm. Then you put your probe on the subsyphoidal view and then record a loop.
Mm-hmm.
This is important because you want to analyze the view in detail and you only have a couple of seconds time until chest compressions should be continued.
So basically there are shockable rhythms and non-shockable rhythms. We are now in the non-shockable part of the algorithm. And this could be basically a systole or a PEA. Now, when it comes to PEA, we often hear two terms, which is true PEA or pseudo PEA. This is a distinction that we can...
If you examine the heart with ultrasound during cardiac arrest and you see the aortic valve opening but you don't feel a pulse, this is a pseudo PEA because the patient has some cardiac output because the aortic valve is opening,
mm-hmm.
but the blood pressure is that low that you can't feel a pulse. If the aortic valve is not opening but there are still some contractions that do not cause a pulse and you can see these contractions also on the ECG, so there are some electrical activities as well. This is then PEA.
Mm-hmm. So the true PEA, the basically the dying exactly. heart in most
the
of the cases.
Heart. And yeah. the important difference is that the pseudo PEA patients have a much better prognosis than the true PEA patients. Because in the true PEA patients, the heart is obviously dying and there are not that many myocytes left that can contract.
Okay, so that makes absolutely sense.
So, what have we learned in this segment? Tom and Ben discussed the crucial difference between true PEA and pseudo PEA, a distinction that can significantly impact prognosis and management. If the heart shows coordinated movement and the aortic valve is opening, but there's no palpable pulse, we call it pseudo PEA. That suggests some level of cardiac output is still present, and the chance of recovery is notably higher. In contrast, true PEA shows little or no mechanical activity on ultrasound. In these patients, the heart is failing, and the outlook is much worse. The key point: ultrasound can help differentiate between the two, and that information should guide the intensity and duration of your resuscitation efforts.
Now, what about the reversible causes? We have been talking about pericardial tamponade or pericardial effusion. We have been talking maybe about pneumothorax.
Mm-hmm. So let's get back to the how to identify potentially reversible causes with ultrasound. So pericardial effusion is relatively easily seen with ultrasound, even in cardiac arrest patients. The one pitfall that you have to be aware of is that sometimes the pericardial effusion is not as black as you have learned, maybe in echo courses.
Because it could be not only fluid, but also, for example, cells or blood or whatever.
In patients who acutely suffer from tamponade, it is usually blood, and blood starts to clot quite quickly, and then it gets grayer. And it also compresses the heart, so the heart looks very small in these views. And it's sometimes difficult to identify, oh, this is the heart, because there is a gray thing around the heart and a very small, compressed, and not moving heart. The question then arises what to do with this finding. Patients who have acute tamponade from a non-traumatic cause usually have ventricular rupture or type A dissection, and there is no way you can treat this in the pre-hospital setting. So once you see pericardial tamponade as a cause for cardiac arrest in a non-traumatic patient, you can say, game over.
Mm-hmm. Which is also having a consequence. For example...
Yes, you do not rush to the hospital with the lights and sirens.
Yes, absolutely.
The second potentially reversible cause that you would like to identify is right heart dilatation as a consequence of pulmonary embolism. When you suffer from a cardiac arrest of an unspecific cause, your right heart usually dilates during the time of the cardiac arrest. And it is a bit tricky to distinguish between this is now a PE-related right heart dilatation or the right heart is bigger than normal as a consequence of the cardiac arrest. So the point I want to make is that not every right heart dilatation in cardiac arrest is PE.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Especially since there are things going on during a CPR process that can cause a dilatation of the right heart. So the last two candidates that we will have to discuss about is hypovolemia and pneumothorax.
Yes. So hypovolemia can be identified from the same view. So if you have a pseudo PEA and a very small left ventricle where you see kissing papillary muscles, you can assume that this is probably caused by hypovolemia, or at least the patient will benefit from fluids. For tension pneumothorax, you have to get a different view. So you no longer look at the heart, but you want to look at the lungs. So you have to use a different spot for the ultrasound examination, ventral chest, left and right. And probably you also have to use a different preset, because for the ultrasound of the heart, you of course use the cardiac preset, and for the exclusion or inclusion of pneumothorax, you should choose a lung preset.
Now let's just summarize things at this point. So that means basically, I can use ultrasound. I have to really think about when to throw it in. I may not prolong any kind of procedures. And the basic thing you just said to me is it can work, but it's not a must that it's going to work.
Well, it will work, but the information that you get from it
is limited.
Is limited, and in most cases does not change your management. But in the few cases where it changes management, it is essential for the patient. So if you really pick up the PE as a cause for this cardiac arrest, you can add thrombolysis, and this can really save the patient.
Absolutely. I mean, it's the same thing when you're thinking about ending a CPR situation and you see on the ultrasound that the aortic valve is still opening. So, for example, if you identify the pseudo PEA in a case where you would have just ended the CPR because you were thinking it was a dying heart.
Yeah, maybe you will come to the conclusion, well, we will try a bit longer, and maybe the patient finally gets a ROSC. In the peri-arrest setting where you still have cardiac activity, you get much more information because the changes of the heart that occur during cardiac arrest are not there yet. So you can really draw firm conclusion from this still working heart. So if the right heart is dilated in a patient who is still conscious and has a pulse, it's quite likely that this is PE, as opposed to the patient who has been in cardiac arrest for 15 minutes and the right heart is dilated. This can be PE or it can be not. And in most cases, it is not PE.
Which is basically what you're asking our providers out there is to just grab the probe and use it in almost any internal case.
Yes, because once the patient deteriorates, you have gained the information before and you can use this information, which is much more valuable.
Now let's shift our focus to a critical window in resuscitation. The peri-arrest phase. Tom made the important point that ultrasound often works best before a full arrest has occurred. In this phase, cardiac structures are still functioning to some degree, and pathology is more reliably identified. Whether it's early signs of right heart strain or a developing cardiac tamponade, the peri-arrest scan can give you vital information that allows you to plan ahead. So, here's the core message. Don't wait for cardiac arrest to grab your probe. Use it early, when interpretation is clearer, and when your actions may have the greatest impact.
Okay, now that we've discussed our classical internal case, let's just jump into the traumatic cardiac arrest. What is important there?
I think it is important that we further distinguish between penetrating traumatic cardiac arrest and traumatic cardiac arrest in general. For both groups of patients, you have to have a clear algorithm that you follow in the initial minutes. So in general traumatic cardiac arrest, non-penetrating, this is open up the airway, oxygenate the patient, stop external bleeding.
The big killers.
Yes, exactly. There is no role for ultrasound in the initial minutes because most of the patients die from bleeding. And if it is not externally, there is nothing you can do about in the pre-hospital setting. In patients with penetrating cardiac arrest, you could use ultrasound to determine whether or not they have pericardial tamponade. But you have to be aware that doing an ultrasound takes at least 1 or 2 minutes. And the clinical consequence of seeing the pericardial effusion is the same as if you do not perform the ultrasound. Because if you have cardiac arrest from a penetrating injury, the patients you want to treat are the patients with pericardial effusion, and the treatment is emergency thoracotomy. And we know that the quicker you are by performing the thoracotomy, the higher the chances of survival are. So for me, in the setting of cardiac arrest, in the initial few minutes, there is no role for ultrasound. There is a role in the peri-arrest setting, especially in penetrating trauma patients, because if you identify pericardial tamponade earlier, then you can prepare yourself and also the entire team for the possible thoracotomy that will arise in the next couple of minutes.
You know what? It's fantastic that you mentioned that, because that brings me to the example, the case study that we've been talking about when we were preparing this lecture. And that was a penetrating chest injury.
Exactly.
We happened to experience that together. I was on the hospital side. You were out in the field in the general University Hospital of Vienna.
It was quite dramatic. So the young guy was stabbed in the chest, but walked into the ambulance. But he deteriorated quite quickly, so that we were not sure whether or not we would make it to the hospital. So we put on the ultrasound probe in order to see whether or not there is pericardial tamponade. And indeed, there was tamponade. But he was still breathing and having signs of life. And the hospital was just a couple of minutes away. So we anticipated that he probably will suffer a cardiac arrest quite soon. And the treatment would be thoracotomy.
And just to get that straight, you witnessed not only the pericardial effusion, but already the tamponade of the heart.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yes.
Which but is a pretty life-threatening circumstance.
Yes. The most important thing that we did is to just grab him without any further treatment and rush to hospital. So our on-scene time was a couple of minutes. And from the time that we identified pericardial tamponade until we arrived in the hospital was 7 minutes.
Which is very close.
Yes. The hospital was a 6-minute drive, so there was nothing that we did on scene. And this was a consequence of the ultrasound, because we could predict that this guy will need emergency thoracotomy in the next couple of minutes. And obviously the best place for this to happen is a hospital. So we rushed him to hospital.
And you know, if it comes to the pre-hospital clamshell thoracostomy, it also lowers the bar from a human factor side. If you witnessed that before and you know that the patient is suffering from a pericardial tamponade, I think it makes it easier for you then to do this really dramatic measure.
If the patient had collapsed during our transport to the hospital, we would have stopped and confidently performed the procedure.
Yeah. Just gives you more self-confidence to do that then.
Exactly, because you know what's happening.
And I think, you know, this is also something the whole team can benefit from, because you can anticipate it and you might can also talk about it with your team. When you brief them that you rush to the hospital, you say to them, listen, we just take him and go. And if the patient goes into cardiac arrest, we're going to perform the procedure, a thoracotomy.
And this is exactly what happened a couple of months later in a different team. They also saw the tamponade and they briefed the entire team. We will now do a pre-hospital anesthesia induction because the patient was unconscious and insufficiently breathing. And after anesthesia induction, the patient got into the arrest and everything was prepared for the thoracotomy, and it was performed without any complications.
Yeah, because the whole team was on the same page.
Exactly.
If I was an unexperienced emergency physician, paramedic, healthcare professional who's dealing with this kind of patients, who's coming repeatedly into cardiac arrest situations, whether it's traumatic or non-traumatic, what would be your best advice for me for my next CPR? Once I'm a little proficient to perform an ultrasound, what are the things you want to give me on my way?
The first thing I want to tell you is do ultrasound in every patient, not only in the cardiac arrest patients, because you really have to be confident in performing ultrasound in these highly stressful situations.
That's why we try to put the probe onto the personal and not stacking it somewhere in a bag. It's all about to have it, to carry it around and just put the probe on every patient. And don't constantly ask yourself, should I perform an ultrasound?
You should in every patient.
Even the ones that do not have a severe problem, just for us to keep the practice high.
Exactly.
And
in the patients with cardiac arrest, you have to brief your entire team and tell them that they should not stop chest compressions until you tell them to stop. And don't be frustrated that in most patients you won't see reversible causes. There will be some patients where you actually see reversible causes, and these are the ones that you can really help.
That brings us to the end of this episode, a deep dive into the potential and the pitfalls of using ultrasound during cardiac arrest. We hope it gave you some new perspectives, some practical takeaways, and maybe even the occasional moment of, wait, I should rethink that. If you have enjoyed this English episode, or if you have thoughts, questions, or just want to share your experience, I'd love to hear from you. Feel free to send me a direct message on Instagram at Dr. Ben Tal. And if you liked having Dorothy drop in with structured summaries, let me know that too. Until next time, stay sharp, stay focused, and keep scanning with purpose. Have a great day.